Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein, and we're in another conversation. We have with us today Rusty Reno, a man who needs no introduction, of course. Rusty, we all know, is a prolific author. He had a long academic career editing an important series of religious biblical studies and different books that have come out over the years, and he has a new one out called The Return of the Strong Gods, Nationalism, Populism, and the Future of the West. This is our topic today. Rusty, thank you for joining us.
Oh, great to be with you, Mark.
Okay, well, now I know there's a historical argument in the book that we will get to, but first, let's begin with a definition. The strong gods. What is a strong god? And maybe I should ask you, what is a weak god as well?
Right. Well, a strong god is anything that evokes in us love, loyalty, and a willingness to make a sacrifice to defend or promote that strong god. So obviously it's not meant theologically, it's meant sociologically, the idea to describe. I draw it from Durkheim, that image of the gods, because Durkheim recognized that every society consolidates around shared loves and loyalties. And so, you know, and a weak god is one that doesn't, you know, you could say that meaning is a weak god, truth is a strong god, to give that kind of distinction.
If you're a literary person like me, I remember being in graduate school and the interpretation of texts, these were the theory years in the 1980s, it just struck me when you said meaning and truth that one did not ever presume to get to the truth of Ode on a Grecian Urn. One could talk about not only what the specific meaning it is, but how it means, right? The poem is a performative statement that can, of course, be taken in a variety of different directions. But to talk about getting into the core truth of the poem, well, forget it. That's naive.
Well, I've got a section in the book, and I talk about, and our conversations in the office really helped me with this, Mark, to recognize the way in which literary, kind of highbrow literary theory about how texts work, even the idea of text, it seems to me, is part of the weak god approach. Because you could say that the Ode to a Grecian Urn as a poem is a kind of strong god in this, if it ravishes you and you become bewitched by it. Mm-hmm. And how do you reduce the power of the poem? Well, the way you do it is you sort of take it apart and you explain how it works. And if you're a good deconstructionist, you can explain how it works according to certain kinds of deceptions, certain kinds of way of masking its own illogic or its own rhetorical manipulation. And so if you're a Marxist, you show how it turns on a certain kind of element of class, or if you're a Freudian, you show how the poem turns on a certain kind of repressed sexual energy, which is actually not an implausible interpretation of that particular poem. And so you can, you know, ring the changes on this kind of critique, this mode of critique, which is a kind of pulling of things apart and showing, like, underneath the skin, how the anatomy is, and that disenchants literature. I don't know. How did you, when you started? I mean, when I was a young student, I had some of that pedagogy, but I also had professors that you would call it literature appreciation, and so, you know, you would take a class on, I remember I sort of read Dostoevsky in some class, and the professor, the lectures were meant to sort of bring out the genius of Dostoevsky's account. And so it's an intensification of its power rather than a diminution or a kind of critique of its power.
Right. And at first, I think that, you know, in the theory days of the 70s into the 80s, I think this turn toward interpretation, toward text, you know, away from book, masterpiece, masterwork, away from the genius of the creator, there was something exhilarating about that. And it seemed to open up the interpreter to his own creative exhilaration of reading, of being a reader. And the problem was that time went by. We got this reading by this person and that reading, a Freudian reading, a Marxist reading, and that the weak god of interpretation, it just became kind of a routine process. And, you know, the thrill was gone.
And people don't major in English.
Well, there you go. There you go. English is way down in terms of the number of majors. And is the implication follow your title of The Return of the Strong Gods, and that being weak gods simply don't satisfy for very long. At least most people can't get through with weak gods. They don't compel that much commitment and inspiration.
I mean, part of the argument, the historical argument in the book, is that after 1945, ideological disaster, global war, the horrors of Auschwitz, there's a political cultural project, American-led, but widely shared, I think, throughout the West, Western Europe, as well as the United States, to try to weaken people's passions. Because, and I think liberalism in general is a tradition of moderation. You know, you don't want to litigate theology in the public square. You don't want to have a puritanical state that sort of tortures people into perfection. And so I think it fits with our tradition. And so you're right when the text gets opened up, so to speak, you know, if you're feeling like, you know, oh wow, you know, we got the geniuses and the masterpieces and like where's room for me to say something? And you're right. There was a kind of excitement, an opportunity for, you know, the reader to have a say, so to speak. And that was an opening up. And I think but you're right. Over time, St. Augustine says, our heart is restless until it finds its rest in thee. And he meant that theologically in terms of God, but also it could be interpreted sociologically that, you know, we're social animals. I think Aristotle saw that we want to unite around some higher thing. Doesn't have to be theological. It could be political. It could be aesthetic. It could be, literature lives on in the Elizabeth Gaskell Society, the C.S. Lewis Society. And these are societies of people who really love the author and the author's works. And so I think you're right. I think we see that in a microcosm in the academy of students kind of drifting away from the cultural studies, which I think is an adjunct to this cultural project of creating an open society. I try to make that argument in the book, which is tied to a conservative side, which is an argument about the ever greater expansion of markets as the organizing principle of social life. You know, so you can get Gary Becker writing a paper about the economics of marriage, which really actually winds up having the same cultural valence, the same disenchanting function as, you know, a radical feminist giving a Foucaultian interpretation of marriage.
But this was part of the point. You say that it was a deliberate effort to weaken passions, to soften commitments in after what they'd seen in the previous 30 years.
Yes, understandable. But, you know, part of the historical arguments is that the Cold War kind of kept us consolidated. I mean, it was a balance. I talk about the Harvard Education for a Free Society Committee, which was founded as the war was winding down, and it was a preparation to win the peace, so to speak. And the committee wanted to balance what they called educational continuity with what they called critical questioning. And so continuity means, you know, great books, you know, the masterpieces, to use your language, of our tradition. And they wanted to balance that with a greater freedom to interpret them in accord with the needs of the moment and give the students an opportunity to sort of to enter into a kind of free interpretation of the mandatory texts. So you can see the balance there between authority and this kind of liberty to do as you please or think as you please. And but all of the prestige was on the side of openness in the 50s and 60s. And so really, I think by the time you get to the 80s and you have the war over the canon, I just think it was kind of already baked in the 50s because they tried to keep the balance, but they gave all of the cultural and moral prestige to the openness, critical questioning side. And so by the time you get to the Harvard Committee on General Education from 2010, 2011, there are no more required texts. So that side of the balance has fallen out. I think you can ring the changes on that at every level of our society, whether it's, parental authority versus individual freedom or, the old mores about male-female relations softened and weakened by a greater openness to, the achievement of women and so on and so forth. And in all of those instances, what I think my parents hoped was a kind of a stable balance between certain new openness with the old continuities has all, over the last 20 years, 30 years, has all resolved into just pure openness. The weak gods.
In your story,
the gods of weakening are better, I think. They're not so much weak gods because paradoxically, political correctness can be very punitive. And so it's its own kind of strength, but it's a god of weakening. So you are prohibited from prohibiting. you're judged if you judge. And so these paradoxical gods of weakening are very widespread in our time.
And they're hard to combat.
Well, because it's the establishment view. I mean, it's the dominant consensus. I mean, I talk about in the book, sociologically, the dominant consensus is, well, dominant. And it dominates by punishing and shaming people who deviate from the consensus. And it's a consensus of weakening, that our society will be better, more just, and more humane insofar as we have less and fewer strong obligatory demands that people have to submit to.
Mm-hmm. Who are, in your story, the main intellectual apologists for the weakened passions, the weaker gods?
Well, I start out with two figures who I think are very influential on the American right and American left. One is Karl Popper, whose great wartime book, Open Society and Its Enemies, makes a case for really, if you go back and read it, it's a radical reconstruction of Western culture. As radical as any Marxist would be, although it's a kind of liberal radicalism, if you will. And then the other is Friedrich Hayek, his also wartime book, Open Society and Its Enemies.
And no, Hayek is Road to Serfdom.
The Road to Serfdom. And those two, and for Hayek, Popper wants, argues for the open society. Hayek argues for the spontaneous order of the market as an intrinsically anti-totalitarian way of organizing societies. And they're both completely preoccupied with staving off the return of totalitarianism. And again, fittingly so. I look at William F. Buckley, who was very influenced by Hayek, and I look at 1950s establishment liberalism in America, which winds up actually echoing a lot of what Popper argues for. And then the way in which those two strands, the left and the right, wind up fusing together by the time you get into the post-Cold War moment. Economic deregulation on the right, cultural deregulation on the left, and by the time you get to the 21st century, the center right and the center left are basically mirror images of each other.
For Popper, who are the enemies?
The enemies are anybody with strong convictions and beliefs. Anybody who is metaphysical. So he attacks Plato as a totalitarian and Hegel is a totalitarian. And so if you think, in to use the literary critical terms, if you think in terms of meta narratives or grand narratives, then you're a fascist.
And what does that leave us with?
A world with no framework, a society with no borders, a culture with no, that doesn't provide a home. This leaves us homeless. And that's part of what I think is at the root of populism today, is this disquietude, the inquietude in French. That is, people are beginning to think, now, wait a minute, the dominant consensus, the people who run things, they're not actually going to shelter and build a shared home in our society.
No, Rusty, I can't help thinking, Popper, do you really think that human beings want to live without a strong feeling for home, without a strong commitment to nation? I mean, patriots feel good about their patriotism.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, as I say, our heart is restless, we're made for love, and we want to love things that are noble. But Popper's in, he sees that this is not psychologically natural, and so he talks about this so-called strain of freedom, and recognizes that you already see political correctness in him. People are going to have to be disciplined to accept a world without truth, a world without strong loyalties, because it's human nature to want to consolidate around those strong loyalties.
Rusty, isn't that right there a totalitarian impulse?
It's a very paradoxical, right?
People have to be re-educated, right?
They have to be re-educated, yes. I mean, and so the first volume of Ovid's Society and Its Enemies is an all-out attack on Plato. So here you have the founding figure of that great books curriculum that the Harvard faculty wanted to sustain, foundational figure for Western intellectual life. And Popper, he had trouble getting the book published, I think, in part by the fact that I think a lot of readers were, for the publishers were thinking, you know, sentiment is good, but, I mean, this is a little too extreme. But he says in the preface to the book that he thinks it's good for us to throw off our habit of deference to great men, as he says. And so, yes, there's a pedagogy there of openness that's going to have to be, as I said, paradoxically strong. And that, you know, so we see it in our time in the universities, and not just in the universities now, everywhere.
Everywhere. And the human resources in corporate America. So we can see how Popper and Hayek, writing in the wake of fascism and totalitarianism that they see on the left, with Stalinism and with Hitler and Mussolini, as the years pass, the Cold War proceeds, we get farther away from the war situation. What does this weakening, weak gods, the assault on the strong gods, does it evolve into social, sexual issues? We sort of start moving away from strict political affairs. I mean, Hayek was concerned about the social engineers in government trying to manage an economy. Hayek wasn't thinking about the sexuality of human beings, correct?
Complicated.
Okay.
I mean, obviously he wasn't, I think, thinking about it. But I think Milton Friedman, you know, one of his great disciples, you know, he was in favor of legalizing prostitution and things like that. I think Friedman...
Legalization of drugs.
I think he would have championed same-sex marriage. I mean, I think he would have welcomed Obergefell, because it expands the scope of freedom so that people can decide to live as they wish. He was a very hostile, I mean, libertarian. He was a very hostile, I mean, he was a thoughtful man and was stupid, but he was hostile to the idea of any kind of strong social norms governing society. But Popper and Hayek were both, they were actually united, and I mean, they were friends and acquaintances, they were colleagues, They both were in England at the end of the war, and they both were part of the foundation of the Mont Pelerin Society, which was wanted to guide the reconstruction of the West along liberal principles. And but they differed. Popper was ultimately a social democrat in the European sense, so a man of the left. And Hayek, although he denied that he was a conservative, was a liberal in the European sense of that term, which would range him on the right here in the United States, and did, in fact, put him on the right. But they both agreed that the nation is an illusion. I mean, that in other words, it's a mystification of and a false kind of community. In fact, I think both of them thought any form of natural community, and as opposed to chosen association, is a kind of false idol. And I think the same thing is true for Milton Friedman. If you see the beginning of Capitalism and Freedom, his book that was probably the most widely read, he really attacks as a kind of crypto-totalitarian any sort of patriotic claim upon our loyalty. So yes, it's a right and a left thing. So it's not just the left that did a kind of cultural Marxist attack on traditional institutions, but it's also part of the right to attack traditional institutions in the post-war era. And that is more obvious in the way in which libertarianism, by the time you get to the 21st century, libertarianism becomes the sort of dominant intellectual force in the Republican Party.
Quick question. Do you think that Hayek and Popper would have regarded the nation as somewhat artificial or illusory if they themselves hadn't been dispossessed émigrés?
No, it certainly contributed to it. There's no doubt. And also to kind of witness German nationalism and its destructive force, I think they wanted to counter that with the strongest possible medicine. And part of the argument of the book is not to condemn Karl Popper and Friedrich Hayek. I think they were men of goodwill and extraordinary intelligence, trying to meet the challenges of their time. But we live in a time where we're not being threatened by over-consolidated, masses of people, rallying around their national flags. On the contrary, we live in a time of what I think is kind of cultural and social disintegration. And so people of intelligence and goodwill need to figure out how to reconsolidate and reconstitute functional societies.
So this gets us to what's going on now, the return of the strong gods. What are the phenomena that you focus on here to illustrate the process?
Well, I think, you got Trump, right? Brexit. Elections on the continent where populist politicians moved into power, Salvini for a period of time in Italy. So I think the trend lines in the political culture in the West is for people saying we want a return at least of the strong god of the nation. So nationalism is, I think, an indication of that. I think there's also underneath there's a percolating anxiety and concern about family that's pretty broad. Although it's more inchoate there, but I think that's going to become more and more politically salient as we move forward. A lot of unhappy people for whom this hasn't worked out.
What about the church?
The church, you see a polarization in the church. The muddy middle of the Second Vatican Council is kind of giving way to either what I would think of as the strategy of weakening, ever greater weakening, which I think I associate with this pontificate, and a kind of neo-traditionalism. So I think the religious orders that are seeing growth are the most rigorous and traditional. And so if you're a young man or a young woman considering religious life, you're attracted to ones that make strong claims on your heart.
Would you want to simplify the conflict we see, say, over the election of Trump or Brexit as a reassertion of, on the part of regular people, a natural desire for home, for country, for sovereignty, versus that kind of, as you put it, the psychological adjustment that the weak gods, the people of the weak gods, are pushing upon people. That we, in a way, we have nature versus nurture going on here, as in conflict. When
I think it's worse than that. I think, you know, it's interesting the way in which the patrons of globalization and globalism often live in homogeneous and protected neighborhoods, and so the global weakening of things, the globalization, the globalists, as Trump calls them, yeah, you know, they have an interest in weakening because it means that the nation is the basis on which we can hold the powerful democratically accountable. But a globalized environment of kind of atomized and demoralized people are easier to rule. So I take a kind of dark view of this.
And that the rulers...
But I agree with you that the populism is our people saying, hey, wait a minute, I want to have a country. That's clearly what's going on in Great Britain.
I mean, I felt that one of the attractions of Trump very early on at his rallies was the way in which he seemed to break down a wall between the famous politician at the podium and the crowd. I mean, compare the relationship that Trump had with the people there, with the relationship Hillary had. Trump would invite people up on stage once in a while and hand over his microphone to a World War II or a Korean War veteran and let him speak. Could you imagine Hillary allowing someone to come in? It seemed that Trump broke that separation.
Well, yes. I mean, certainly as a gift, he's a kind of gifted performer in that regard. But I would draw more emphasis on his rhetoric. I mean, wall, tear up the trade deals, stick it in the eye of political correctness. Those are all consolidating motifs. I mean, the wall is literal consolidation. In other words, that's a direct attack on the openness motifs that are so dominant, became so dominant and obligatory over the last generation. And I think, you know, a lot of people on the left, it just horrifies them. I mean, they say, okay, borders are necessary for now, but we published in First Things an article by Peter Hitchens 2 or 3 years ago on the beauty of borders and aesthetic defense of borders. And I loved publishing it because it was basically saying the world's a better place for borders. They're not necessary evils.
Good fences make good neighbors, Rusty.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but I think your term a moment ago, the horror that they felt, the recoil at a wall there, made it clear that this is not about a political policy. This is something much deeper. And I think your language of gods, strong and weak gods, is the right language here, and that we have to start talking about what is sacred, what is taboo or not, that ordinary politics don't really apply here.
Well, people would say that's not who we are. That was a Barack Obama. He liked to say that certain things were not who we are. And I think that's the right way to think about it. I mean, I disagree with him about who we are. But that, I mean, I talk about in the book about it, that this is at the level of what I would call metaphysical dreams. And the book is an attempt to really outline the dreamscape that has become so dominant in our time. And the dreamscape is one of openness. It's a dream of kind of limitless horizons. Openness, plenary inclusion, diversity without end.
Diversity without end for what?
Yeah, diversity towards what end? Diversity is a good in itself in this metaphysical dream. And so if you look at what corporations use to advertise, You know, you know what the dominant dreams are by looking at how the advertising people are trying to sell soap and shampoo.
Yeah, I would make one comment upon your remark on the Obama line. That's not who we are, Rusty. He spent a lot more time rebuking people by saying that's not who we are than a positive, affirmative, clear message of, well, who are we?
Right.
Who are we?
That's the paradox of the God of Weakening wants to fend off any positive definition. He would say diversity is our strength, which is sort of obviously not true. It's not. Diversity is not something that makes you stronger. I mean, the talents of the people or what have you, or anybody running an organization knows you have to have unity around the common purpose that you're seeking to achieve. It's become one of the God terms of our time, diversity, no question about it. When I think when people talk about diversity, what they really are saying is they want solidarity. That's a very different notion. And solidarity comes when you're united around a shared love. So you need strong gods to have solidarity.
I mean, I hear the word diversity in academia all the time. And Rusty, it's just like a, well, it's a litany that has no meaning anymore. But it's empty.
It's
routine. It's also not a strong, it's a weak term. It's binding. But it has no depth to it. I mean, the people just mutter it as a matter of course.
It shows you, the fact is, you don't get educated in diversity, you get trained in it.
there you go.
And that tells you everything you need to know about what that word does. It's part of a, right, it's a way of policing the establishment consensus. Some people have it. Other people don't have it. It's very interesting when you start looking at the way in which people use the word diversity. It's, what would it mean to have diversity or not to have it? It's very interesting. So, but this is all coming to an end, and that's the argument of the book, is that the post-war era is ending. And
there's no going back from this return. We don't know what form the return will ultimately take, but we're not going back to the weak gods anymore. I don't see it.
I don't see it either. And our duty as Christians and as responsible citizens is to try to nurture the loves, the strong gods that are ennoble people rather than the ones that debase them. Because there are certainly strong gods that will debase because there are idols, so that's part of our job, is to try to nurture, you know, the loves and loyalties that are ennobling of our fellow citizens rather than debasing.
This might be a programmatic statement for First Things Magazine.
It is. That's what we're all about.
Yep. The book is Return of the Strong Gods, Nationalism, Populism, and the Future of the West. Thank you, Rusty.
All right, great. Thanks a lot.